2944B, and Senator Metzger moves that we reconsider the vote by which we suspend the rules to reconsider the vote by which, is that right, John?
That's right.
We passed out House Bill 2944. Any objection? Senator Metzger moves that we reconsider the vote by which we pass Senate Bill, House Bill 2944 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Any objection? The bill is now before us. Committee staff, would you tell us what's going on here, please? I believe there's an agreement here that's been worked out on this bill, according to the chair. Did you?
It's not my bill.
Which was that?
2944, first bill up. Mr. Campbell?
We have three amendments.
Where's?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'm here today to embarrass myself again because I had testified to a portion of House Bill 2944, which in fact ended up not properly in the bill, and so it went to the floor with a critical piece missing, even though I think I had testified three separate times in front of different committees about the presence of that. So I guess believing it's there doesn't make it so. So we have today worked with counsel, and I want to thank Virginia for her work to draft this, a correction in the form of the B-10s. The B-10s basically clarify that in this bill we've created new policy committees made up of the professions that make up a good part of the public safety community. And these policy committees then would be responsible for making decisions regarding policy and would forward them to the 23-member board. As you remember, the 23-member board in itself is an unwieldy board for the purpose of determining policy. And so what this -10 amendment does is it basically clarifies that the board has some ability to send an issue back to the policy committees in the event that there's a confusion or the need on the part of the board to see more work done. And then the board may also overturn a decision of a policy committee based on a two-thirds vote of the committee. So the B-10s now integrate what we thought was in the bill all along, and I want to thank the committee, the chair, and the Senate for sending it back to committee to give us a chance to correct it.
All right. What about B-11s and B-12s?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll go ahead and speak to them because I did work on the amendments. The B-11s were a first shot at addressing the need for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to do vehicle pursuit policy. The -11s basically created a large fiscal impact, and so we took another shot at it, which are recorded in the B-12s. The B-12s basically require the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to include in their minimum training required for basic training certification as a police officer, the law, theory, policies, and practices related to vehicle pursuits, and then when they're able to also make sure that that involves vehicle pursuit training exercises. That, of course, would occur when a pad for high-speed vehicle training is available when a new public safety academy is built. Now, so the -11s are not what we'd like to pursue. It's just the -12. Thank you.
What did you just say? Did you just say
wait, 10 and 12?
You 10s want to do and 12. 10 and 12, you don't want to do 11.
Not 11s, right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll just start out. Mr. Chair, I move the B-10 amendments to House Bill 2944.
All right, Senator Courtney moves adoption of the B-10 amendment to House Bill 2944. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move the B-12 amendment to House Bill 2944.
All right, Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the B-12 amendment to House Bill 2944. Any discussion?
Thank
objections?
You.
Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2944 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves. House Bill 2944 is amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. So order, and I believe I was the carrier on that. Anybody want to volunteer to carry that?
It's up to you.
Senator Courtney will carry it.
Steve and I remember a little bit about it.
All righty. 2007. Public hearing. Possible work session 2007. There should be an agreed upon amendment. So who are my participants? Brian Bo. Campbell.
Shake my head. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Bo, and I'm here this morning representing the Oregon Grocery Industry Association. House Bill 2007, A. Engrossed, is a bill that would require the OLCC to develop uniform standards for minor decoy operations. These standards ensure that the operations are conducted on an objective selection criteria and avoid procedures that might constitute entrapment. We've been working with the OLCC and law enforcement and the governor's office on this bill, and you have before you the A6 amendments. The A6 amendments reflect an agreement amongst the parties to make some changes to the bill, the A. Engrossed version. Specifically, they would, on page 1, line 22, they delete the term statistically from the phrase statistically random. And then they, at the bottom of that paragraph on line 26, insert that the commission shall adopt by rule a methodology that prevents, to the greatest extent possible, the inappropriate targeting of licensees or agents. And what we're trying to accomplish here, what the intent is to provide direction to the agency to develop standards for minor decoy operations so that they are conducted on a random basis unless there is a documented compliance problem with a licensee or agent. The second amendment is on page 2. It deletes subsection 7 beginning on line 18. And that deletes what would have constituted an affirmative defense for someone who is convicted of making a sale to a minor if the agency had not followed the established standards.
Brian, mm-hmm. Just cut you off here. If I understand correctly, everybody is in agreement. The OLCC is neutral on this, and this is a compromise that's been worked out between the parties and the governor's office.
That's the sum total of it right there.
All right. Anybody have questions?
We're in work session.
We are in work session, 2007. Yes. Jenny?
Just a quick question. Why, if you don't have statistical randomness, how else would you determine randomness? I thought statistically was the only way you could do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's been a subject of lengthy discussion this session, and we've kind of gone round and round on it. The agencies were concerned with being confined by the term statistically random in statute and would prefer to develop that on some basis in rulemaking and to the greatest extent possible ensure that it's statistically random without being confined to that specific standard inscribed in statute. And we've agreed that to do that.
Is their intent to?
The intent is, yes, the intent is to achieve a statistically random basis to the degree, to the extent possible. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move the A6 amendments to House Bill 2007.
Senator Cordy moves the adoption of the A6 amendment to House Bill 2007. Any discussion? Objection? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2007 as amended to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves House Bill 2007 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Harper, would you carry that for me?
Be delighted.
Thank you, sir. Public hearing, possible work session, House Bill 24.
Number.
Have a sign up sheet.
Number.
2424.
Good morning,
Brad.
Chair.
How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm the State Court Administrator's Office. House Bill 2424 is a bill that was originally introduced by the Oregon Judicial, at the request of the Oregon Judicial Department, was amended in the House. The basic problem this is trying to solve is that when the statutes were originally written relating to uniform citations, they were written in terms of paper citations, which make it difficult. If people wanted to go to e-citations or electronic citations to do that. The bill gives some rulemaking authority to the Chief Justice so the Chief Justice can adopt rules to allow electronic citations. There are a couple of police departments that are interested in doing electronic citations. The city of Portland already has an RFP out on the streets. They've had there since March. The state police have been talking to some vendors about doing it. We think that it holds the potential to make it easier for police, courts, and everybody in the system, so we think it's a good bill. The bill also allows for e-citations for parking offenses, which is an issue in Portland. I've seen the Dash A4 amendments, which were presented, the ones that require the Chief Justice to report to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology before adopting any rules. We don't think the amendments are necessary. We actually work with them on a regular basis. We'd be thrilled to go to them if they want us. All they have to do is send us a letter. On the other hand, if you want to burn an ORS by adopting this, I suppose you could do that. But like I say, we work with them on a regular basis. We think they would need to know. Most of what we would do with rules would be driven basically by the police departments that want to get into the business to begin with, because they'd have to buy the equipment and they'd have to work with them. So before their rules, we'd have to.
Brad, I don't disagree with you, but the chair of that particular committee,
that's
his amendment, and so in order to please him, I don't think it does any damage to put in statute, does it?
Okay.
Work session.
Mr. Chairman, move the A4 amendments to House Bill 2424.
Does the committee have the A4 amendment? Okay.
I don't think everybody does.
Just make sure you've got it. Okay.
They do.
We do have it. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, Senator Cordy moves to the adoption of the A4 amendment. Any discussion? Objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2424 as amended Senate floor due pass recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves House Bill 2424 to the floor of the Senate as a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, sir.
So if I get this right, you're going to be sitting at your home computer possibly. Are they just going to be sending out parking tickets by email?
Oh, Brad, share with us. That's not a bad idea, though.
Well, Chair Menas, Senator Beyer, for the committee, the technology is new and moving. Eventually, we would like to have people be able to pay tickets over the Internet. That's potentially in the future. The e-citation technology is the front end of that process, where the officers, and there are some handhelds out that you've seen on the street, potentially, where they're using for parking. And in other states where the officer has pull-down screens and does tapping and it enters all the information and prints out a ticket that they hand to the person, and then they go back to their office and they plug it in and it downloads the information and sends the information electronically to the courts, to the DA, to whoever needs to know. And part of that process could eventually be putting it up on a screen so somebody could pay a parking ticket or a regular speeding ticket through the Internet. It's all part of a process that's developing, but the technology is new, and we're interested in heading in that direction if we can.
I did hear you say that the officer is making the contact with the person physically in person, and if the guy's not sitting at home and all of a sudden he gets an email ticket.
Senator Beyer, a couple of years ago you did pass a bill on photo radar, and there's photo red light. So those are mailed. I don't know if we'll ever get to the point where those end up on somebody's email as opposed to having a hard copy mailed. That's not currently something we're planning on, but we don't know where the technology is going.
You had to bring up red light and radar, didn't you?
Lost that book.
Did that answer your question?
All right. Any further discussion? Any objections?
Yes.
No objections. Bill's gone. Who wants to carry that fine piece of legislation? Senator Burdick, would you carry that?
Yeah.
It's a City of Portland kind of bill.
Okay. I can't read that.
All right. Senator Burdick will carry that bill. We're going to go to 3642, public hearing. This is the criminal forfeiture legislation. The committee will remember that we had some public hearing on civil forfeiture.
Yeah.
Okay. Diana something. The Fulhams, is that right?
Diana.
Vidalins, okay. I was at risk of mispronouncing it. I thought I'd go ahead and just stumble all over myself. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. My name is Dinah Vidalins. I'm here from the Oregon Department of Justice. House Bill 3642 represents piece of legislation that law enforcement, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the OCDLA, and the ACLU, and Oregonians for Property Protection agreed to. House Bill 3642 provides for criminal forfeiture in certain criminal cases. Some of the features of 3642 are that an individual must be indicted at all for all either misdemeanors or felonies unless it's a city court case, in which case information must be filed. The case must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the individual committed a crime and the property that was seized is either instrumentalities or proceeds of that crime. The way it would work as an example would be that if police officers executed a search warrant involving a forgery ring, all the instrumentalities, the computers, all the counterfeiting equipment could be seized and then forfeited. As far as the proceeds of forfeited items, the distribution is as follows. 40% to law enforcement, 40% to drug treatment, and anything forfeited by the Oregon Department of Justice or the state police goes to the state office for drug and alcohol. The 40% for drug treatment, if it's a local authority, would go back to that local authority. 10% to the general fund, 7% to the illegal drug cleanup fund, 3% to the asset forfeiture oversight committee. Our committee would very much like to thank Virginia Vanderbilt and Marilyn O'Dell, because without them, I don't think we could have gotten to where we are today. That's all I have.
All right, and this is a bill that primarily was worked on the House side, but all of the parties have worked on the bill. And I want to just make for the record a clarity that Andrea Meyer from ACLU wants to make it clear that they are neutral on the bill. So.
Oh, that's a win.
Woo! That is a win. There are no amendments to the bill.
No.
Mr. Chair, I move.
Work session.
House Bill 3642A engrossed the Senate floor. Do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves. House Bill 3642A engrossed the floor. The Senate. The do pass recommendation. It is. Any discussion?
This is the Article 3 bill, right?
Well, except that it does comply in the sense that it requires a criminal conviction.
You
have a conviction before you take the place. No objections. Senator Courtney will carry this.
I'll carry this bill. Why are you going to vote against the bill? You got to be arrested. You got to be convicted.
Okay. Are you voting against it?
No, I said
it. Oh, on the floor. Okay.
I haven't looked at it yet.
All right.
I'll take the heat, buddy.
Which one?
Take the heat, buddy.
All right. Where are we? 2503. 2503. This is Representative Cruz's bill. This is the other half of Senator Metzger's sex offender bill. He had Senate Bill 444, and I understand there was some dialogue that you had with Representative Cruz because you had competing bills, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So there were some things. This one is a complement to it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. 2503.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2503A and Gross to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves. House Bill 2503A engrossed in the floor of the Senate of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Anybody want to carry a sex offender bill? Senator Metzger will carry the sex offender bill.
Do we need some sex offender vote?
Who's going to carry that one?
Metzger.
So they did all that, yeah.
All right. This is the biggest bill of the entire session. House Bill 2949.
What? This looks like one of my bills.
2949. It's a huge, huge bill.
Are we in work session?
We're in work session.
I move House Bill 2949 to the Senate. Oh, the due pass recommendation is almost comical.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2949 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Meyer.
The bill that changes the Ten Commandments?
No, it's not shalt not. Right.
The 10 suggestions. Okay. No further serious discussion. Any objections? Gone. Senator Duncan does get a carry.
Yes.
He's gone. That's did you want to carry?
No, I've been attempting
to build. Oh, okay. All righty.
Blue.
3464. Do we have a sign-up sheet for 3461? Anybody out there care about 3461? If you care, come forward.
You have to be passionate.
Yes.
Merely caring.
Hey, I'm a co-sponsor. This must be a good one.
Yes, sir. Hey, I saw your name last night. I hope you care. You're on it.
You and Burke. Introduce yourself for the record and very quickly. Sure.
Grant Nelson, Lane County Community Corrections, and to my left, Dave Cook with, still Clackamas, isn't it? Clackamas County Community Corrections, and he's also the president of the OACCD, Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. And to my right is Ginger Martin with Department of Corrections.
All right. So.
You know, Menace?
So we got some opposition to this. So. Mm-hmm. You're Ginger Martin, right? Who's leading on this discussion?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go for it, sir.
David Cook, Clackamas County Community Corrections. This bill was offered for two reasons. One, that the total number of custody units available for sanctioning are now limited in sentencing guidelines rule. Because of that, each time any of the custody units are used to respond to an incident of noncompliance during probation, this use must be tracked so as not to go above the legal limit. With no reliable method of tracking custody unit use on a statewide basis, local jurisdictions are placed at risk of imposing an illegal sanction. More importantly, there were limits on jail sanctioning units were originally designed to aid jail population management but are no longer needed for this purpose, and the supervisory authority powers, which now exist in statute, provide an effective way of managing jail populations. In the vast majority of counties, jail managers and community corrections officials work cooperatively to manage the impact of sanctioning on local custody resources. No change in the amount of jail custody units imposed at the time of initial sentences proposed in this legislation, and that's intended to maintain the fairness and consistency aspects of the original sentencing guidelines law. While this proposal eliminates the overall limit on use of custody units during the period of probation, it does retain limits on the number of custody units imposed by probation officers in response to each probation violation. This practice, the rule on structured intermediate sanctions, maintains well-established guidelines contained in Oregon Administrative Rule dating to 1993. Furthermore, this legislative proposal aligns probation sanctioning practice with that employed in response to violations of parole and post-prison supervision. The same staff, adult parole and probation officers, supervise offenders who are simultaneously on probation and parole or post-prison supervision. Now to the heart of the matter. Opponents of this legislation suggest the due process rights of offenders are seriously eroded in this process. To the contrary, numerous procedural safeguards are in place. As mentioned previously, administrative rules limit probation officer discretion as regards the frequency, severity, and duration of sanctions imposed. Before any sanction is imposed, an offender must voluntarily agree to the sanction after being advised of their rights, and a copy of that notice of rights is attached to my letter. Once the offender consents to the sanction, this action is submitted both to the sentencing judge and prosecuting attorney for review, either of whom may require the offender to appear in court for a probation violation hearing, at which point the sanction is rescinded. Finally, there are concerns regarding increased use of jail as a sanction. In virtually every county, jail managers and community corrections administrators work in partnership to manage finite custody resources. The ability to routinely impose lengthy sanctions simply does not exist due to very limited custody options. Limits on the length of sanctions imposed by probation officers in response to violation behavior is one mechanism used to manage local jail resources. Use of frequent, short-term sanctions is consistent with best practices research and can be used in lieu of revocation. When revocation occurs, the most frequently imposed sanction is 180 days. At the point all allowable custody units are used, revocation becomes the only option available to the probation officer in court. This legislation allows community corrections agencies and jails greater flexibility managing offender behavior with frequent short-term sanctions, reserving revocation for those high-risk offenders who indeed deserve such action. And very briefly, there is data. In 1999, the legislature increased the maximum amount of sanctions that could be imposed per incident to 60 units. I have data on the use of felony probation sanctions from the six largest counties in the state. In calendar year 1998, the average number of units imposed in response to a violation via sanction was 14 units. In the year 2000, that average was 19 units per incident. We haven't seen the dramatic increase that some of the opponents of this legislation contend will occur, and I believe it's simply good practice to allow this legislation to go through and give community corrections and local corrections agencies the greater flexibility to manage our resources.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name again is Grant Nelson with Lane County Community Corrections. And I just want to emphasize one point that Dave made, and that is that in order to manage these individuals who may be on supervision for up to a year and a half for crimes such as possession of drugs, we have available to us about 15 days of jail time. And when the offender's behavior continues to be non-compliant and we run out of custody units, our only option is to take that case back to court, and what usually happens is a 180-day revocation sentence. This represents an extreme use of jail for what we really need is the next 5 days or the next 10 days of sanction power and ability. With this change, it will be the offender's behavior that drives what happens to the offender, and I think it brings the two processes, the one for post-prison supervision and the one for probation, into line with each other, which makes the administration of these cases much simpler for our officers and much less prone to the creation of liability issues.
Okay,
thank you.
Let me find out why these other people can't stand the bill or not support it, and we'll bring it back up if we need to. So if that's okay with you. Okay. Bill Hauser, OCDLA.
Chair Minnis, my name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do not like the idea of taking away the cap on the sanctions. And I'm going to testify to you today a little bit about the experience that I have in my county. And frankly, it's not a broad experience. I've been doing criminal defense and prosecution for almost 18 years. But probation violations are something that happen every so often that we deal with, that I personally deal with. But what I find is that when I have a person who is on a particularly a felony probation, which is what we're talking about here, who has gone through their initial sanction at the time of sentencing, whatever that might be, 10 days or 30 days or whatever it is as far as sentencing guidelines is concerned, and then goes through a process of informal or the structured sanctions, which generally are 5 days, then 10 days, then 30 days. Once they get to that 30-day sanction, they haven't used up their custody units, usually. But at that time also, they usually come back to the court, and the court's not really interested in having them stay on probation. And so at that point, depending on what my client wants, of course, and depending on what we think is the best interest of my client and my representation of the client, I'm trying to keep them on probation while the court generally does not. We don't feel that there's a need, particularly in my experience in my county, we don't feel that there's a need to take away the caps, because a person who has had the three probation violations, at least in our county, the court's not all that interested in continuing them on probation. If the average sanction, for example, as we just heard, was 19 units, you'd have four 19-unit sanctions under a 90-day cap. And after four, maybe there are judges out there, and maybe, Chairman, you have more information on this from your county, but in our county, the guy's not going to be on probation any longer. So we just don't think it's necessary. We don't particularly like the idea that under the intermediate sanctions, there would be no cap on custody units at all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Sir?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Bruce Leibowitz. I'm here on behalf of Leibowitz & Associates and also the consortium of Lopez, Leibowitz & Halley. We have the probation violation contracts to defend those cases in all of Multnomah County. And I've heard various rationales for this bill, including that it would somehow save costs, that it would reduce the indigent defense budget, that money could go elsewhere, and I take exception to all of those premises. I had a discussion in this building last week with Lane County DA Harkleroad at a meeting addressing this bill, and I said, isn't it your experience that after a second PV, probation violation hearing, a person is revoked anyway? And his response was, in Lane County, if a person isn't revoked by the judge on a second violation hearing, that his office will not even appear on that matter, that they take no further interest in it whatsoever, that the judge can't come to that conclusion after two violation hearings. Before the person's even gotten to the judge, there have generally been a series of sanctions. I haven't heard it seriously argued that a person is going to use up all the available resources. Yet this bill is asking for an open-ended sanctioning of probationers. There's no limit. It's only limited by 60 days each time. So theoretically, a person could go through a 60-day sanction, a 60-day sanction, another one, till they've actually, in essence, served their entire revocation sentence of 6 months. If that's the case, and a person comes into the court and they've served 50, 60 custody units, because there are great variations from county to county in how they're imposed and what programs are available, then a person can be revoked, and then the judge can turn around and say, well, you're a failure, so I'm not going to even give you credit for those 3, 4, 5 months served already. This would have to cost a fortune to the counties and to the sheriffs to say that this bill, the result of this bill, will track with the parole results, post-prison supervision that now exists, is just comparing apples and oranges. There's a perception amongst the probation population that somehow when they get off probation or on parole, it's easier, that there's less conditions, and also parole usually is less lengthy a period of time. I would also take exception to the implication that the people being revoked on this are high-level offenders or high-risk offenders. The average person revoked under this bill is a low-level, level one grid drug offender. That's the overwhelming majority of the people who are subject to this, at least in Multnomah County. And when you take a drug offender and revoke them, it doesn't make them any more dangerous. In fact, the shift in terms of treatment in this country, and particularly in the West, is towards treatment, greater contact with the court, not less contact, which this would do, which is basically make the probation officer the judge, but to have greater contact with the court, and as was stated, frequent but brief sanctions, be it jail, community service, work crews in the mountain. There's a lot of different things that can be done. But I would submit that it takes away an individual's rights, subjects them to a much greater sanction, and the knowing waiver of somebody without counsel, gee, you don't have to accept this. You can go back to the court. Most people have no idea what their rights are because it doesn't tell them, that waiver still doesn't tell them options other than you can say no and go to the judge. But I'd say the main problem of this bill is that it wrecks the working premise of the structured sanctions that were put in place in 1993. I was on that task force, and the levels were done on the task force to address these very issues. I think it is possible to modify this bill, but in the current form, I would say it's a very bad piece of legislation.
How would you modify it, Mr. Davis?
Mr. Chairman, there are grids in place on the structured sanctions. It would be quite simple. If DOC is claiming that they need more custody units, even though that somehow is going to save money, you just build those custody units in. You can step them up. If a low-level drug offender has the possibility of 90, this probably no one's going to understand this, but the grid that will say 90 over 30. That's total custody units versus the bottom line is jail days available. For example, 30 jail days can be imposed on the drug offender before they're expended. It can simply be expanded to 40 or 50. There's no, if it's about adding additional jail and the theory is that's going to make someone ultimately more compliant and less likely to be revoked, that can simply be done. But this takes the caps off completely. It doesn't address what happens if someone served months and months of sanctions and then gets revoked anyway. And that would have to result in a huge cost.
All right. What I'm going to do is ask the various parties to go out in the hallway and chat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll close the public hearing. So the proponents and the opponents go out there and see if you can work out some kind of compromise. And the next bill of 2560, public hearing, Representative, you are here for your bill. I'm staffless, so completely lost. Morning, sir.
Good morning.
Would you share with us what this bill does?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2560 is a minor in possession piece of legislation which basically requires courts to order suspension of driving privileges for failure to appear in court when a minor in possession has been cited. House Bill 2550 sends a strong message to the youth, young people who drink and drive in Oregon. The message is that underage driving will not be tolerated. Under the current law, youngsters cited for minor in possession show up in court, face normally a Class B violation. While there's a 37% no-show rate, experience shows that these no-shows usually get off scot-free. This legislation applies to all minors, not just juveniles. And I want to emphasize that there's another piece of legislation floating around that had the right relating clause relating to juveniles, and so it only applies to folks under 18 years of age. And so this bill applies to all minors, not just juveniles. When passed, this legislation will give us another arrow in our quiver to stop minors from drinking and driving, and it sends a strong message when the sheriff shows up at these youngsters' homes, let them know that they don't have a license.
Excellent testimony. Paul Cosgrove from Distilled Spirits, big support this. Mr. Hauser, OCDLA, supports this. Sandra Bishop, Wine Institute, supports this. John Stovall, OLCC, supports this, yes? All right. Work set.
Chair, I move House Bill 2560, A and Gross, Senate floor, do pass the recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves House Bill 2560, A and Gross, to the floor of the Senate with a do pass the recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Burdick.
No money.
Any objections? Hearing none. It's gone. Who wants to carry that? Senator Burdick? No? Oh, Harper wants to carry it.
Ow! She hit me!
Did you see that, Mr. Chair? She hit me.
I did.
Okay.
I'll let y'all raffle.
Senator Burdick can carry it.
Senator Burdick can carry that bill. 25. That can only be done with.
Hands enough for the Burdick.
Huh?
Hands enough for Burdick. We did that earlier.
I'm glad she wasn't packing.
Oh. How do you know?
I think we've been here too long.
I don't think so.
Ron didn't.
I don't think I'm wrong. I don't have a problem. That's the only public hearing is open. But I don't think I'm saying that last night to myself.
What are you talking about?
House Bill 2686, public hearing.
What is it, please?
2686.
That's all I'm saying.
Who cares about this bill? Matt Farmer. This is a good bill, right? Nobody signed up in opposition to it. What does it do? Not that I'm in a hurry or anything.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jana Jarvis with the Oregon Association of Realtors. I have with me Matt Farmer, our general counsel. This bill just seeks to clarify what is and isn't material in a real estate transaction. Already, murder, death, suicide, and AIDS are excluded under ORS 93.275, and this would clarify some of those subjective issues like group homes, transient social conditions, and things like that. The intent is not to, it is always the seller's responsibility to define the condition of property and title, but the intent of this is to put some of it on the buyer.
Okay, whip session.
Chair, I move House Bill 2686A, engrossed Senate floor, due pass recommendation.
And Courtney moves House Bill 2686A, engrossed Senate floor, Senate due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Hearing none, it's ordered. Senator Courtney, you want to carry that?
Sure.
For who wants to carry it? Senator Harper, no?
No, make Burdick carry it.
Make Burdick carry it.
Good idea.
Trying to figure out which ones don't have a lot of testimony here. Let's do House Bill 3857.
I guess we'll see.
3857. This is the Gaddy bill. OCDL, why don't you come on up and tell us why you don't like this bill? Let's start with the opposition. Then we'll bring up the proposal.
Thanks, Senator. I'm Bill Hauser with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Our position is that no lawyer should be advising people to be dishonest, and that's the position that we're holding on this bill. That's the testimony we gave to the House, and in a nutshell, there you go.
All right. That's it, huh?
In a nutshell.
All right. Pete Shepard and Mark McDonald, come on up here and tell us why you think this is a good idea.
John, is this the fix to the Supreme Court deal?
Aye.
Quickly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. In a nutshell, the Supreme Court's ruling in a disciplinary matter involving a Salem lawyer, Mr. Gaddy, has significantly impaired the ability of law enforcement, both civil law enforcement authorities and criminal law enforcement authorities at the state and federal level, impaired our ability to carry out the missions that you have assigned to us. Under the ruling, no prosecutor, including the Attorney General or any district attorney, can order an investigator employed by the prosecutor to conduct an undercover investigation. This has effectively shut down the undercover portion of our consumer protection enforcement effort. It has also shut down our ability to carry out our organized crime investigative and prosecution responsibilities. The rules apply to United States attorneys by virtue of federal legislation. The problem is particularly acute for federal attorneys because under federal law, federal prosecutors must actually approve certain kinds of undercover investigations. And under the currently applicable rules in Oregon, federal prosecutors are not able to do that. And finally, Mr. McDonald and Mr. Brad Berry, the Yamhill County District Attorney, are here to talk to you a little bit about the impact on district attorneys. House Bill 3857 fixes part of the problem. The Supreme Court relied on a statute, and House Bill 3857 amends that part of the statute that was at issue in In re Gaddy. The problem for a complete cure is still going to require some action by the Supreme Court in the form of amended disciplinary rules, and we're trying to work with the court to create circumstances under which that can take place. I should note for you that the Department of Justice has consistently throughout the process of trying to deal with this opinion suggested that our preference is for a statute and a rule that doesn't authorize lawyers personally to engage in misrepresentations. We prefer this bill to no bill at all. If our ultimate wish were granted, we would prefer a bill that doesn't directly authorize lawyers themselves to engage in misrepresentations.
Let me just make a couple of comments for the record. Some of the early renditions of this bill had a specific language that would require, or at least give the power to deputy district attorneys or district attorneys to approve certain covert activities. Now, I objected to that language, and I think what we've got here is something that's more permissive, because at least in my thinking, it seems rational to have law enforcement have at least the capacity to go to the district attorney's office and say, look, here's what we're going to do. You know, do you think we're within the bounds of reason here in terms of the law, and to receive counsel? So that's, I think, the idea. And I want to also go back to a situation that occurred in Portland back in 1979, where we lost one of our police officers by virtue of the execution of a search warrant, and he was shot to death in that execution search warrant. And interestingly, the drugs and vice officers did not have a confidential, reliable informant underlying that particular affidavit. And these were some officers that were doing some things they shouldn't have done. Many of them were fired and indicted and whatever else for that. And that's where Portland's policy came about, that any time I write a search warrant, in order to follow the process, I have to go to the deputy district attorney and show the affidavit to them and work with them. And sometimes those affidavits and the work that we do does involve some covert activity. So I think, having worked under both systems where we didn't have any legal counsel, we weren't required to do that, is problematic in terms of what you do and in terms of your work. So I think it's a good idea. So anybody else? Any questions? Senator Metzman?
Yeah, if one of you could help me with this. Just reading this, it sounds awfully broad. What the chair pointed out is fine, and I would certainly agree to that. But it talks about participating and using forms of deception for the purpose of enforcing laws. Is that as, I mean, to me that just seems any law. I mean, am I wrong in reading it that way, or is there a narrow scope that's covered by this that I'm missing somewhere?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I think it is intended to be quite broad, because there are many laws that the government attorneys are charged by legislatures or by the Congress with enforcing. So the bill is drafted to cover, for example, civil enforcement efforts in our consumer protection arena, as well as criminal law enforcement efforts. So that it is intended to extend to a wide variety of laws. I think the notion of the checks and balances, though, are ultimately that all of these law enforcement officials are accountable in one way or another through the nature of their office. Prosecutors are charged, as you know, with not merely obtaining convictions, but with seeing that justice is done in the courts. And besides that kind of overarching obligation on prosecutors, there are a good many checks and balances in the form of, for instance, district attorneys are elected, as the attorney general is. So our belief, Senator Metzger, is that there are checks and balances, though the language you cite is broad.
And I want to mention, too, there are at least five Portland police officers who are also members of the bar who work in various capacities where they oversee or may oversee some of these undercover investigations by virtue of their employment, and they're also attorneys, so they have a conflict on the existing system.
Chairman Minnis, members of the committee, Senator Metzger, my name is Mark McDonald, a deputy district attorney from Multnomah County. I'm in charge of the drug unit. Also, about 25% of the FBI are law enforcement officials, so it's very important for them to be able to perform their duties.
Our lawyers, you mean?
Yes.
25% of the FBI agents are
our lawyers. I'm sorry.
All law enforcement agents.
I'm trying to get ready for a trip to Europe, and I've done without any caffeine for several days, so having a difficult time tracking. No, about 25% of the FBI are lawyers, so the Getty decision has been very problematic for them. I would note that Multnomah County, as a result of the incident that Chairman Minnis mentioned, also instituted rules that require, under the local court rules, that all affidavits for search warrants be approved by a district attorney before the judge will even sign them. So this has been a very serious problem, and I think it's very important public policy for those types of activities to be reviewed by a prosecutor, because we can give them very valuable advice as what they can do and what they cannot do.
Right. Did you have something else to add? Or?
Just a couple of comments, Chairman Minnis and members of the committee. I'm Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney. I come from a slightly different perspective in that my county is a medium-sized county. We have about 84,000 people, not like Mark's or, of course, from the perspective of the Attorney General's office. Our drug team is an extremely active team, which has been involved in busting some 20 methamphetamine labs within the last 18 months. And I might point out that as Gaddy rolled down and our office was forced to exclude ourselves from the process of reviewing search warrants, it genuinely put the team in a position of having to rely on their past expertise, looking at how we rejected or asked them to modify search warrants and doing that all on their own, and leaving us to support search warrants later on that may in fact have a defect that could have been cured with a simple review by our office, which we no longer could do for fear of being in violation of the Gaddy ruling. The larger the county, I think the more resources are available to law enforcement. The smaller the county, the more they must rely on the district attorney's office for assistance.
All right. And again, I think the intent is that law enforcement obtain legal counsel, at least some advice. And I'm not sure what the objection of the court is or where the bar, I know the bar tried to work out a resolution of this and the court rejected that. So hopefully we're getting closer to the target here with this. So. All right. Can we do a little work session? 3857.
House Bill 3857 and go to Senate floor due pass.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3857 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Courtney, would you want to carry this?
Okay.
You are, in fact, a lawyer. All right. Where's my list? All right, 2394, public hearing. Let's start with the proponents of this. Who's in favor of this? 2394. Bob Jundup. 2394. Oh, you're again it. Is there anybody for this? You are. Did you sign up? Oh. Margaret. Oh, there we go. Margaret Taylor is for this. Oh, okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah. But isn't she coming up? Margaret, come hither. Yes, she does.
Well, right. Talk about timing.
Since you're the only person that seems to like this bill, you want to tell us why?
Okay. I'm Margaret Taylor, and I'm here on my own behalf. Essentially, I worked for 3 years at the Psychiatric Crisis Center. I also worked for 18 months at Marion County Jail. The reason why I like this bill is that I've seen a lot of people being discharged straight from the jail that were on 23-hour lockdown straight into the community. And then when I saw them again as a screener at the hospital, I didn't have any information about the types of things that had put them into the jail. Essentially, just I think last week we were at a run at Fannie Ann Memorial Hospital, and I ran across a friend there who worked at Oregon State Hospital. He indicated that three of his people that he worked with at the hospital had been sent to the emergency room from injuries received from people who had been placed into the forensic unit at the hospital. Some of the people that we're working with are very dangerous. And what we found is that the best prediction of future dangerousness is past dangerousness. And so please let the LEDS information, which is the most reliable source of that information, in at the time when we need to make that whole decision. That is our only time to catch someone before they're released out onto the street.
Okay, help me understand this. The bill, as it was introduced, allowed some access to LEDs. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And you're speaking in support of the engrossed version?
No, I'm in support of the main bill, not the amendment. So I'm in support of the bill as it is now.
The A engrossed. That's
the
A
engrossed.
So what did the House add that you like?
The House added a provision, essentially the original bill just had the information coming into the civil commitment investigators. And if you look through the materials I'm handing out, that would be 5 days too late. The information needs to come in at the time that the screeners and the doctors are making the decision whether to hold the person or not. If the information is not in at that earlier phase, then they cannot use that information to decide whether the person needs to be held or not. So the original...
So moves access to LEDs up?
Up, at the time when you need it.
All right.
As you know, information when you need it is of the essence. It's no point having that information come in 5 days later.
All right. Thank you. Now let's hear for the opposition. We have a host of thousands here. No. Are you all together? ACLU, the whole nine yards? Just come on up. Okay, yeah, I get it. For any reason, you lose four calls.
Caught you getting away, huh?
All right, just quickly, tell me why you don't like what she's doing.
My name is Richard Templeton. I'm with the Mental Health Division. I'm here to reiterate our prior opposition to the bill, and there are several bases.
Oh, you opposed the bill to begin with?
Yes. Well, the A engrossed version.
I want to talk just about the amendment the House put in it that you don't like.
You did
like the bill as it was introduced, correct?
Yes, as the original version.
You liked the bill as it was introduced?
Yes.
Bob, you liked it as it was introduced?
No.
You didn't. Andrea, where were you?
We were neutral on the original bill. Yeah.
Neutral, against, 2-4s on the original version. Okay. So tell us what you don't like about the amendment the House put in it.
There were three things. One of them had to do with allowing access to the people that Margaret is asking that they be given access. We were in favor of LEDS access being given to the investigators in that they have a number of days to consider this information before incorporating it into their report, whereas the screeners that Margaret's referring to have a matter of minutes or hours to consider the same information. The other objection we have is the House added access to pertinent arrests. We had endorsed access to convictions with the belief that convictions is a more reliable source of information. Arrests haven't been vetted through the court process and so is a less reliable basis for information. Finally, the opposition of the Mental Health Division is to the inclusion of the word may have access. The Mental Health Director or designee is listed as changed from shall to may. Our concern was that would introduce a wide variation in the practice of how civil commitment investigations were conducted and the information that was based on them, with possible concern that would violate equal protection.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frances Baker. I'm appearing here today in a private capacity. However, I'm also appearing as the former chair of the legislatively appointed work group that spent many, many months working on the original bill. The amendments that Ms. Taylor proposed were debated at length by that work group. During at least 4 separate meetings, we debated those amendments. The majority of the work group voted against those amendments. The discussion centered on the issues that Mr. Templeton brought up, the fact that decisions are made very quickly in the emergency rooms on a hold decision. LEDS contains arrests, which may never have led to any conviction. They contain arrests that, as I've learned in talking with mental health workers, often occur because the police call the mental health caseworker and say, we've got this person who's a client of yours, they're trespassing, they're bothering people downtown, what should we do? And the caseworker says, take them to jail, they need a bed and 3 meals a day. So it's not necessarily indicative of violent behavior. We don't believe that arrest should be available to people making quick decisions in an emergency room. Ms. Taylor mentioned that past behavior is the best indicator of future behavior. If you look at the statute and look at what is the test for whether a hold should be placed on someone, it is present dangerousness, danger to self or others at the time they are in the emergency room. It's not whether they're going to do something 4 days later, 4 months later, or 4 years later. We had heated debate about this issue, and we strongly felt that there should not be access to LEDs for people making the initial hold decision. We agreed, however, that the civil commitment investigator could have access to LEDs because the investigator has 5 days in which to research the information that they get off of LEDs. They can find out the basis behind some of the things that appear on LEDs. We also discussed what would be the meaning of being able to look into arrest for the investigators, having the same concern that they may not have led to a conviction. It was agreed that the arrest might give some factual information and may give the names of some witnesses the investigator could then talk to and get further information. The fact of the arrest was not the important factor. It was simply getting the names of other people to talk to. For that reason, in the original bill, the investigator was only allowed to report convictions in his report to the court. He could look at the arrest in order to get background information, but could not report arrest to the court. In Ms. Taylor's amendment, she allows the investigator to report arrest as well as convictions to the court. Again, a citizen is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Arrest are no indication of guilt of behavior. This bill would allow people to be held against their will, to lose their freedom in psychiatric settings, on the basis of prior arrest. And we had grave concerns about it. The legislative work group was appointed for a reason. It was appointed, it was a group of people selected by the legislature to come together and discuss these issues. We did it for months. We followed the process. My concern is that if one member of the committee who's disgruntled with what the rest of the group has done.
Well, can I just hang on just a second before you get too far afield here, okay, and I have to lecture you.
Okay.
Apparently, the House Judiciary Committee thought enough of this amendment to stick it in. So
yes,
if you're going to impugn someone, you're impugning the House Judiciary Committee. Because this is the legislature now sitting, so notwithstanding the work of that work group, and please don't come in front of my committee and impugn members of the House.
I did not mean to do that, Senator
even
Menace. I'm sorry if that's how it was interpreted. I certainly didn't. That was certainly not my intent.
Right.
My intent was simply to point out that a work group did put a lot of work into it, and as a group had decided that these amendments were not appropriate.
I see. Yeah, but apparently you didn't prevail in the House on this issue. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. So the wisdom of the Judiciary Committee in the House of Representatives didn't agree with the majority of the work group, apparently. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. Bob?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junip from the Oregon Advocacy Center. We've opposed this bill. As I point out in my written testimony, we are particularly concerned about the amendment that was added in the A. Engrossed. And very simply, yes, this matter was debated in the Interim Judiciary Committee, and in fact, it was also debated in the Attorney General's work group from the session before. The question a broader debate has to do with how relevant past criminal record behavior is in use in the mental health system. Our concern is primarily that mental health beds are an extremely scarce resource, and we want to make sure that when a person is brought in for consideration for use of those resources, that you look at their mental health situation at that point, and you make that decision based upon their need for mental health treatment. Now, adding in the criminal record information through the part of the process in which an investigator gets it, we have opposed that, but there are some
checks and balances on that in terms of what gets to the court. And really, it gives you an opportunity, that provision gives you an opportunity to test whether access to that information might be valuable in terms of public protection and the commitment process. So what I would ask this committee is to take one step now. Take that one step, see how that one works. If this really makes a difference, maybe we can come back and consider the second part about using that information on hold. But right now, let's just take a look and see how that works with the at that later point.
All right. Andrea.
Chairman and Senate members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Meyer, legislative director of the ACLU of Oregon. We are neutral on the -A5 amendments before you, which ostensibly take the bill back to its original version before it was engrossed. And a few points I simply want to make. LEDS is designed for law enforcement purposes and not for outside community use. Officers are highly trained to use and understand the LEDS program. We don't believe that the criminal history should be used to determine whether that person is a danger to themselves or others at the moment. There are practical problems with providing this kind of information to individuals at the hospital in such a quick turnaround. This is usually within a 24-hour time. It can be in the middle of the night, and there may not be the law enforcement personnel available on a 24/7 turnaround to give and explain the information that will be handled over the telephone and to interpret what it reveals and what it means. And it's highly prejudicial to individuals without safeguards that those steps and the opportunity to examine LEDS records more detailed would allow. Use during the week-long investigation has some of those safeguards. It allows adequate oversight by the police who are specially trained to look at the LEDs. It allows for judicial oversight, and it allows for the individual to have counsel at the time to ensure that the record is adequate and correct and complete. Thank you.
All right. So now the issue that we're kind of discussing here is the appropriateness of arrest information as it applies to individuals who may or may not be held in a civil hold environment. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Okay. So, Senator Cornyn,
go ahead.
I guess I'm kind of in a quandary with this thing. I personally have no interest in the bill. So, I don't know whether y'all care that much about the bill and you'd like to salvage it or not.
I had neglected to mention in my prior testimony that Mental Health Division is asking that with the A5 amendments, the bill be returned to its original form.
All right. Senator Cornyn.
Okay. Let me just tell you how I see what's going to happen here. Yeah. Let's say we adopt this amendment and return it to its original form. We get it out of this committee, it goes to the Senate, it goes back to the House. The motion will be made not to concur, and it's going to end up in conference committee.
It's going to end up there.
Sooner or later, I think you're going to have to decide how you're going to work this thing out. Now, that's my call in terms of what's going on here. And that's just my tummy tells me that. And so I don't know.
Senator Menas, Senator Cornyn, others who've been involved in this testimony process a little longer than I may correct me. I was present at the judiciary meeting the evening they passed this out, and there wasn't the discussion, at least on the record, of this issue. There may have been discussion off the record or through individuals, and I simply don't know. I just, on the record, didn't hear a lot of discussion of the issue brought before the committee to determine whether they wanted to go forward with those amendments. And
Let me explain it then even further. I know a certain person will be on that conference committee. You understand, Andrea?
I got it.
Get the signal now. So what I'm saying is probably it's going to require that kind of effort. That's all I'm going to suggest to you in terms of where this thing's going.
Senator Duncan?
Well, mine's, Mr. Chair, mine's similar. I guess I'm trying to say, Andrea, you say you're neutral.
No, Senator Duncan, we are not neutral on the engrossed version, which is before you today. We are opposed to that version. We would be neutral
if the... Okay, I feel a bit better because I thought for neutral, you certainly...
No, we were neutral on the -A5 amendment.
You just see her when she gets mad.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, neutral earlier today, but not...
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I hesitate to speak on behalf of the work group again, but I would say on behalf of the work group, they certainly would like to see the original bill go forward.
All right, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Y'all go talk to Representative Max Williams, Chair of the House Judiciary Committee. If you can get him to agree to the A4 amendment or some agreement in the middle, then I'll be all for it, whatever compromise you come up with. Otherwise, the bill's dead. Okay? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing. Oh, right then. I don't know. I thought I lost my list.
Yeah, you're starting to go with this stuff. I don't even have a bill. Well, geez, you got it all by your heart. Judiciary, which will assess my bills. What bill? You mean the floor? What are you talking about? Oh, it's on. Oh, okay.
All right, have we done 2942 yet?
I can't go on my list.
We haven't done it yet.
2942, public. Who cares about 2942? You can't wait.
You know 2942?
Yes, 2942. There it is.
You might want to mention.
Well, this is another agreement, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. All right.
Yes.
Just share briefly with us what the agreement is.
I don't know.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Burright, Lynn County Sheriff, this morning representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. You have Amendment A8 before you. As the chair indicated, this is a compromise amendment, and we sincerely appreciate your patience and indulgence as all the parties have worked through this. Unless something's changed in the last minute or two, there is agreement between Oregon State Sheriff's Association, Oregon County's Department of Corrections, and the Governor's Office on this bill. What it does is sets the procedures and so forth for the grant and aid. Yes.
The question is, are you talking to AA amendments?
Yes.
What happened about, please, could you help me at A7?
Pardon me?
A7.
Mr. Chairman, Russ Spencer, for the State Sheriff's Association. The A8s represent the culmination of wordsmithing and negotiations between DOC, AOC, and OSSA. So really, that was an earlier generation of trying to get to the same point.
Thank you.
What's and the objective of setting up this interim committee or task force is to do what?
Again, the nutshell we've heard this morning. During this last session, if I'm using my own opinion, the wheels kind of fell off the truck. And a lot of it, I think, had to do with communication and the ability to for all the parties to make sure that their concerns were known and addressed. And this committee allows that to happen. I think it'll be a very important committee, so that each of the counties and the sheriffs and DOC will be working together to make sure that the appropriate funding formula is developed. And in my opinion, that's the bottom line.
And for the committee, this is dealing with those 1145 inmates in county jails that would otherwise be in the state penitentiary, yeah, but for Senate Bill 1145.
I remember this. Yes,
you do remember this.
Oh, sure. All right. Mr. Chair, I move the dash A8 amendments to House Bill 2942, please.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the A8 amendments to House Bill 2942.
Discussion?
Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2942 as amended to the Senate floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2942 as amended to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you carry that bill?
Russ. Am I sheriff's okay on this thing?
Fair sheriff, please.
All right.
Is the Clackamas County Sheriff on board?
Yeah.
What other sheriffs are? What other sheriffs you got?
Yamhill
County Sheriff.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that every sheriff in the state is on board.
All right, Senator Beyer, all of your sheriffs love this. Okay.
Wouldn't they love it?
Well, they like it. All right. No. And we've made some pretty good progress.
Oh, we're doing great, babes. You're rocking and rolling, Mr. Chair.
Pretty good. Move down to.
Got a green, buddy.
Oh, Jimmy.
2429. Work session. 2429. This is the civil forfeiture bill that we heard a while back. And this is the codification of the Measure 3.
Okay. This just makes everybody. This is big stuff.
Yeah.
We've got to do this.
2429.
Tell me the Palace of Ballot Measure needs legislation.
Anybody want this?
You want the bill?
Going once.
Yeah, we're doing 24.
Going twice.
Why, sure, I move House Bill 2429 to the Senate floor of the DuPage Recommendation. Jeez!
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2429 to the floor of the Senate of the DuPage Recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Courtney gets to carry this. No, that's fine. 3931, work session. Where's my counsel?
Which one'd you call now, John?
Well, what did we do on this thing last time? Did it kind of blow up on us, or do we have some?
I'm not sure what happened with 3931, the original bill, but we have amendments that you should have that resolve conflicts in another bill.
Okay.
That's Bill 114.
All right, this is the one we got off on all kinds of archaeological digs and
oh, yeah.
farmers' backyards and basements.
No, I remember this, yeah.
Yes.
The A2 amendments or A3? You got
A3. The A3 amendments.
A3, A2?
Yeah, A3.
Mr. Chair, in work. We're on 3931. You want the in work session?
Well, just one second. Who's this? Are you staff to this? Or this?
I wasn't staffing the original 3931. I know about Senate Bill 114.
Are you staffing it today?
Sure. And what I know is that there is a strong need to adopt the dash A3 amendments to 3931.
What about the
A2? I don't know anything about the A2.
Anybody know about the A2 amendments to 3931?
Anybody know anything? I don't have a bill with me.
Well, here's the bill. This is, I don't know if I'm putting down trauma. Traumatic. Yeah, that's right, you did. Yeah.
Okay. Sounds kind of logical, doesn't it?
I got one, so you can
the A2 there. Amendments?
All right.
Mr. Chair?
I'll move the A2 if you want.
No, okay.
All right. We're going to do this. We're going to run. We're going to lock and load here. You guys ready?
Yeah.
394. No. Kenny, don't take anything serious about that. Lock and load. All right. All right, Senator Duncan moves the adoption of the A2.
The A3 is that.
39, 31. Does the A3 have the A2 in it?
I don't know what the A2 is about.
You don't know what the A2 is.
All right, certified smart people come up here. So this is going to be good. This is a team here.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the DA's Association. This is what I would term a technical fix to the language.
The A2?
Yes. Okay. And I'm forgetting what the language was before as far as a law enforcement agency that seizes. I think it was giving notice to another agency, and all they were trying to do was to say that really, the person who's going to be in court on this case is the district attorney. So give your notice to the district attorney so that it is available in the court process. That's my recollection of how this language came forward. And it really was a clarification because they had the wrong agency in there. That's my recollection.
Also, Mr. Chairman,
it's logical.
Just reading through this, it looks to me like in the original engrossed bill, they have to actually turn over the evidence.
Yeah.
In the amendment, they have to give the notice.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, and Senator Burdick, thank you for refreshing my recollection. Because the district attorney, we don't have evidence lockers, we don't have the capability to take charge or custody of this item.
It's all coming back, it was actually my amendment.
Yes.
Actually, I thought it was my take-home amendment.
Okay, Senator Duncan moves the adoption of the H.O. amendment. Since it's mine and I have a proprietary interest in it. Any objections? Here you go. Senator Courtney,
I move
dash
three
A3 amendments.
A3 amendments. Any objections?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3931 as amended to the Senate floor of the DuPage recommendation.
Courtney moves House Bill 3931 as amended to the floor of the DuPage recommendation. Discussion. Objection.
No.
Your no.
Senator Byer will be shown as a no. There are no other objections. Passes, Senator Courtney will also carry that bill. All right, then. We're going to go back to House Bill 3461.
I think it's very good.
And all of the interested parties that went out and chatted.
Where are we? 3461. Oh, jeez. Oh, this gets good.
Are you all happy campers now?
We are, Chair Minnis. Thank you very much. Members of the committee. Hallway work continues to fascinate me as to its efficacy. The agreement we reached is that with the existing groupings and sentencing guidelines in the grid itself, we would increase by 30, 45, and 60 units. The existing 90 over 30, 120 over 60, and 180 over 90. I know that's all technically...
All right, we need amendments drafted, though, right?
Yes, we can. This can be accomplished by rule via the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. However, we need a statutory directive to change the rule. And so we had asked for the committee's counsel assistance in doing that.
Okay, we're going to be meeting again on Thursday briefly, so we'll get the amendments drafted.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is the other group doing the same thing on the other
one? In action. Resolve it in 20 minutes.
Can we get a courthouse desk? That's how you do it. It's amazing what happens when you get
a little fire under your face. What time is your committee meeting?
Right now. 9:30.
Okay, well, we're going to have to... 2007. Are they here? 2007, folks. Let's move to 2007 briefly. Apparently we didn't do this right. Actually, it's not our fault. When you send these working groups out, sometimes they don't get all of the language.
Want a motion to reconsider?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules to consider the vote by which we sent House Bill 2007 to Senate floor.
Senator Courtney moves that we reconsider. Suspend the rules for purposes.
Right. To reconsider the vote of House Bill 2007.
Suspending the rules for the purpose of reconsidering House Bill 2007. Any objections to suspending the rules?
Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which we sent House Bill 2007 to the Senate floor.
Senator Courtney moves we reconsider the vote by which we sent 2007 as amended to the floor of the Senate. To pass. Any objections to reconsideration? None. It's back before us. Okay, guys, what happened?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chip Lazmi. I'm Governor Kitzhaber's legal counsel. Yesterday, I communicated by email with Mr. Bowe some objections I had to the A6 language that you adopted earlier. He apparently didn't get that email. I guess through the technology, the faster we go, the slower we get sometimes. I have some language that I have discussed with a number of the stakeholders that are here, and they're before the committee in the form of an A7 amendments. I know that Mr. Bowe and the grocers have not had an adequate opportunity to digest this language, although I think we may be able to get them to agree to it. Our earlier plan was to try to insert these concepts in a conference committee since the bill had already passed out of here. My understanding is that the committee's desire is to try to deal with this issue this morning. I can't speak for Mr. Oxley or Mr. Bowe in terms of their position.
We'll hold this over till Thursday.
All right.
So you can get all the principals together and make sure that we're all on the same page.
All right.
Is that okay?
Oh, thanks, right. Senator.
And we are going to be adjourned for today. Thursday will be another meeting.
So when I come back Thursday, John, I'm going to do the same thing, 8 to 9:30.
Yeah, 8 o'clock to 9:30.